KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. If you had 5 minutes on stage, what would you say? That's the premise of Ignite Seattle, a regular event where presenters get 5 minutes and 20 slides to get a point across. Speakers at last month's event touch on a variety of topics, including viral videos, online dating, and how to give up cheese. The talk was moderated by Seattle Times columnist Monica Guzman. The first speaker is Jonathan Coleman. His talk is called How Introverts Can Survive in an Extroverted World.
If you're like me, and I am, you're an introvert. Who's it? Who's an introvert tonight? My introvert brothers. My introvert sisters. Yeah, be proud of who you are. My name is John Coleman. You can follow me on Twitter, at @jcoleman. And I just tweeted out a link to my slides if you'd love to re-experience this. I want to tell you about the world we live in. It's an extroverted world. I think you know this, right? I just talked about Twitter. We're constantly being asked to share. We have to always give of ourselves. We always have to interact with people. But what does it mean to live in an extroverted world as an introvert? Well, a lot of people think that introversion is all about shyness and fear and anxiety, but it's actually really different from that. It's all about energy. It has to do with how you gain energy and how you drain energy, and it's not at all the same as shyness. So introverts lose energy when they interact socially, like I'm doing now, whereas extroverts gain energy through those interactions. But that doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with us. There's nothing wrong with introverts, nothing wrong with being introverted or feeling like you don't have enough energy. You're perfect just the way you are. There's nothing broken. Because introverts are strong leaders. Barack Obama, Steven Spielberg, Rosa Parks, Albert Einstein were all introverts. Introverts are amazingly creative people because they have a strong interior world. And they also, because of that, they make great lovers, because let me tell you something. If an introvert focuses on you, you will know it. The thing is, we're just a little quiet about it, right? We don't always speak up. We don't always have the energy to do that. We choose our words carefully. We choose our time carefully. So tonight, what I'll be talking about is five tips that you can use as an introvert to get along in this crazy extroverted world. The first tip is something that's going to help me right now. I'm going to focus on, say, you. And hi, Jen. When you're in a situation like I'm in now, when you're at a party, a conference, an event, you're speaking, it really helps to focus in on just one person, and it makes all that energy you lose to the crowd, it sort of brings that down a little bit, and you can actually have a good interaction. My next tip is to share an activity. So when you find yourself at an event that drains your energy, what you can do is focus on the activity instead. And that helps you from losing that energy to all the other people around you. Plus, you deepen your relationship because you're actually doing something useful. The next tip is to feel free to recharge. One of the difficulties that introverts have is that they lose their energy so quickly through social interactions. Again, this is really tiring me out. So something that you can do is feel free to step out. And you know what? I'm feeling kind of tired. I think I'll take a break right now. Okay. Go on the Twitter, tweet something, check my updates. Oh, look, Kate Morris is here. Oh, hey, Kate. Okay. So, I feel really recharged now. I feel great. This is a trick that you can use. You can step out, go for a walk, take a break, check your Twitter. It's okay. So that's the thing. Be direct. No one's going to know you're an introvert unless you tell them. It's not at the top of their mind. They're not magically going to guess. And if you haven't ever told someone that you're an introvert, try it sometime, because I think you'll be really interested in the reaction you get. and it'll give you a chance, again, to deepen your relationship with that person. But you can't do it unless you're honest with yourself. Honest with other people starts with honesty to one's own self. So you have to understand that there's nothing wrong with you. You don't have a reason to beat up on yourself, to punish yourself, to set expectations for yourself, for interacting with others that you can't fulfill. Once you get to know yourself as an introvert, you'll stop doing that. You'll stop beating up on yourself. And so you see that we can survive in this world of extroversion. We can get along as introverts, but surviving isn't good enough because introverts have deep hidden steel inside them, and they can do more than just survive. They can thrive. Thank you. I'm Jonathan Coleman. Have a great evening.
Thank you, Jonathan. So we've all had our adventures. Our next speaker is going to talk about one in a talk that she decided to title, We're Gonna Die. So welcome to the stage, Wendy Hinman.
We're gonna die. Sounds so dramatic, doesn't it? It sounds like this big abstract idea, this thing that's in the faint, distant future, not really gonna happen to us, it happens to other people. And we think about, you know, the retirement home and all the things that we're gonna do between now and when we get there. But the thing is, we really don't know how long we have. I have a friend who went to the store for a gallon of milk, and she never made it. Her car was rear-ended, and it flipped, and she spent the next 2 weeks in a coma, and her friends and family closely monitored her progress, or lack of it, and we finally had to admit that she wasn't coming back to us. When I was 25, my husband and I had a really serious car accident. On an icy day, a double-tanker diesel truck sideswiped us, and our car looked like a little tin can. It was about a fraction of the size that it had been. Surprisingly enough, I remained intact, and so did he. But we were forever after really wary of things that took away our time and energy from what we really wanted to do, that time in the cubicle under fluorescent lighting doing things we didn't really want to do. So within 8 years, we bought a sailboat with the idea that we were going to take off and explore the world and see what was out there and take control of our time again. We didn't have a lot of money, so it was a small sailboat. In fact, my husband couldn't actually stand up in the thing. But we realized pretty quickly that we didn't need a lot of necessities to have some pretty grand adventures. So while we lived without a lot of what people would consider necessities, we figured that the necessities in life were really the two of us together working as a team, and keeping a sense of humor as we faced many character-building opportunities. We had many moments when we thought would be our last. We encountered typhoons and storms and ships and reefs that threatened to turn our home into kindling. But we spent our days hiking to the top of mountaintops, to lush tropical waterfalls and to beautiful caves. And made it all pretty worthwhile. There were definitely times that were pretty scary. We were out on the ocean in the cold North Pacific, and a ship came out of the fog rather suddenly without enough time for us to really react or even deploy a life raft. And I thought, we're going to die. This is it. But in that moment, I thought, you know, it's all been worthwhile because I did something I really wanted to do. That wasn't actually the ship. I wasn't busy taking pictures at the time, but we survived that experience. And each time we struggled, we just felt that much more alive because we were spending our time really taking a moment to see the beauty that nature puts on as a show every single day. Well, as all good things must, our trip came to an end, and we came back to Seattle. And let me tell you, it was a pretty harsh readjustment back to the cold, dark days of Seattle after these brilliant blue tropical skies and brilliant sunshine. I got pretty depressed when we first got back, and I really didn't quite know what to do. But as a longtime writer, the one thing that I did do was I poured my thoughts and my emotions, raw as they were, into words on the page, and it helped me get through it. And little by little, I crafted something. I'd always wanted to write a book, but I never really knew what I would write a book about. Well, duh, this is my story. So I created a book, and I can now hold it in my hands. And since that time, I've had plenty of opportunities to share our story with people like you. And so I've had to tackle that next fear, which is getting up here on stage and putting it all out there. Pretty scary stuff. You think crossing the ocean without anything in sight is scary? That ain't nothing on this. But what I realized out there is that my fears would loom large until I just looked them in the face and went after them. And so I say to you, what is it you most want to do in life? What is your passion? Do you want to climb Mount Rainier? Do you want to start a business? Do you want to write a book? Do you want to sail the oceans crazy as I am? I urge you, do it now, because you don't have any idea how long you have. Thank you.
Thank you, Wendy. So in our work lives, there are some things that we can count on, and there are some things that we can't. Our next speaker, Lindsay Sharma, is going to tell us about something that she thinks we should be able to count on. Lindsay.
Papua New Guinea, Liberia, and the United States. What could these three countries possibly have in common? Now, some of you might be tempted to get out your smartphone and look that up right now, but I promise I'll let you know by the end of this talk. So I want you all to think back to your early life experiences. I mean, way back. It might be hard to recall, but I'm sure you've seen pictures. Who was there with you? And how do you think that having them there has impacted you as an adult? Let me share with you a little bit about my own story. My mom was always around. She was working as a third grade teacher when she found out she was pregnant. The school district she was working for offered 3 months of maternity leave, which is pretty good, but she decided to quit. She told me she fell in love with being a mom, and she didn't take another job until I went to preschool. Then she decided to be my preschool teacher. I guess she really liked spending time with me. But my mom was able to take that time out of the workforce because my dad could support us. I'm a healthy, well-adjusted adult. Well, I guess I should let you all be the judge of that. But from what I've learned studying public health, I now attribute that to the fact that my parents were able to support to provide me a good, solid start in life. Research shows that the first 1,000 days of life are critical for a person's lifelong health. That means from conception, throughout the pregnancy, until a child's about 2. We now know that around half of our health is programmed during this short window of time. Half of our health, that's a big deal. There's also evidence that shows that the quality of nurture and care during these first 1,000 days not only affects the health, but the social skills and the intellectual potential of a child for his or her whole lifetime. So for my thesis project, I spent the summer interviewing working moms about their experiences. And the things that I heard were heartbreaking. The women I spoke to work in all different professions and are in different income brackets. I met a woman named Fabiola who works in a physically demanding job. She worked as late as she could in her pregnancy in order to take just 6 weeks off with her son. I also met Lori, a paralegal, who had to go back to work just 4 weeks after childbirth. She ended up having a C-section that cost her close to $10,000 in medical bills, and that was even after insurance. I also met Kristen, a lawyer. She was working on a court case late in her pregnancy, and she continued to work past her daughter's due date to finish up the trial. When I asked her why she didn't take time off beforehand, she told me the firm offered a very short leave and she wanted to spend as much time as she could with her daughter after she was born. Unfortunately, these women's experiences are not uncommon. Most new mothers here in the U.S. lack any paid leave. So some take unpaid leave, some quit, some even lose their jobs when they need them the most. Others are able to use their sick time, disability, or their vacation leave. But none of this is guaranteed, because many times it depends on your employer. Many of you in this room probably get paid family leave through your work. The software industry is well known for providing some of the best family leave benefits. And for those of you who do get paid family leave, I urge you to take that time to care for your child. It's a lifelong investment that you will not regret. As things stand here in the U.S., not all children are given an equal start. When paid family leave is a luxury, like it is in our country today, some children start out at a disadvantage. When there's a false start in a race, we start over to make sure that it's fair. We can't do this with our children. For these reasons, paid family leave should not be a benefit for employers to bargain. It should be available for all. And that's how it is in most of the world. Most countries have public policy that guarantee moms, and in many countries, dads, paid time off after childbirth, called paid family leave. This ensures that parents never have to choose between providing essential care for their child and their careers. By now, some of you may have gotten your smartphones out and found out what we have in common with Liberia and Papua New Guinea. We're the only three nations in the world with a population over 1 million that do not mandate paid family leave. The United States is the only developed nation that does not guarantee this benefit. And I don't think that we should settle for this. It's unacceptable. And so if you want to learn what Washington State is doing to ensure that all working families here in our state have access to paid family leave, you can visit this website. Thank you.
Lindsay Sharma, speaking as part of last month's Ignite Seattle event at Town Hall. Her website is waworkandfamily.org. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of Ignite Seattle by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
More from Ignite Seattle in a moment. 823-949-KUOW. Pianist and conductor Daniel Barenboim talks about the Arab-Israeli Orchestra he founded along with his friend, the late Columbia University literature professor Edward Said. That'll be tonight at 10:30. Canada's correctional investigator tells why he thinks Aboriginals are overrepresented in federal prisons in his country. Also, a remembrance of Canadian folk music icon Stompin' Tom Connors, who died yesterday at age 77. An ambitious mayor lays down over $1 billion to start a bicycle revolution in London. And a prominent voice of the international left considers Venezuela's future after the death of its president, Hugo Chavez. All of those items tonight at 11. Weather forecast for the Seattle area for tonight, lows somewhere in the 30s, mostly cloudy. Chance of showers this evening. Friday, highs around 50, mostly sunny. Friday night, lows around 40, partly cloudy. Saturday, highs lower to mid-50s, sunny skies.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Ignite Seattle is a regular event at Town Hall. Speakers get 5 minutes to deliver a speech on a topic of their choice. Seattle's 19th Ignite event took place on February 20th, 2013. It was moderated by Seattle Times columnist Monica Guzman. The next speaker is Sarah Kiesler, whose talk is called How to Give Up Cheese.
The average American eats 33 pounds of cheese each year. For me as a kid, it was more like 33 pounds a week. I'd trade desserts for cheese at the lunch table and begged for a grilled cheese every day in the summer. But in 2003, after watching a documentary on pig farms, I gave up meat. But I told my vegan roommate proudly, never giving up cheese. But in 2009, after one last mozzarella-covered slice of veggie lasagna, I gave it all up. Here's three reasons why. Number one, your health. Try researching the science behind cheese. It contains pus and mold and the inner lining of a cow's stomach. That flavor you're tasting is actually unregulated bacteria strains. Number two, your health. Cheese contains roughly 70 to 90% fat and tons of artery-clogging cholesterol. That cream cheese on your bagel, 90% fat. Now, I know some people say eating cheese is a great source of calcium, but the fact is, your body actually steals calcium from your bones in order to process the acid content in dairy. In fact, a 12-year study of 78,000 women found those who drank milk once a day had a 45% higher chance of a hip fracture. Now, how many of you out there are allergic to dairy? Yeah? I bet there's more than that. A USA Today report found that 60% of adults are allergic to lactose, and many of them don't even know it. 60% of you in this room are allergic to dairy. Part two, the animals. So, you love your cat or dog, right? Well, imagine if your dog spent her whole life without sunlight, pumped full of hormones and antibiotics, stuck in a dark, narrow stall, unable to turn around. That's a dairy cow's life. And remember, to produce milk, a cow must be nursing. So she's artificially inseminated again and again with no break in between births. And if she has a male calf, it's locked in a tiny cage to become tender veal. And I'm really sorry, organic dairy eaters, but that's actually more painful for the cow. Without the antibiotics and painkillers, it's a really painful process in order to cure their udders, and half of cows' udders become infected. Part three, the planet. So if each American cut meat and cheese from their diet for just one day a week, it'd be the same as taking 7.5 million cars off the road. That's all the cars in all four of these states. And cheese is right behind lamb and beef for its contributions to climate change. That's because it takes 10 pounds of milk to make 1 pound of cheese. So it's actually better for you to drive your car than to eat cheese when it comes to climate change. And this is about environmental justice. In California, there's 1.5 million dairy farms. And those kids near those farms are developing asthma as high as 1 in 3 kids that live near it. All that manure and fertilizer goes somewhere. So now that you have the knowledge, try an elimination diet and see how you feel. Try one day and then two. I did 2 weeks before that cheese, and let's just say my stomach thanks me. And the best part is, you can still have all the taste you crave, just without the health risks and cruelty and destruction to the planet. I make an amazing cashew nut cheese ball that gets eaten faster than anything else at a party. And I know vegan cheese doesn't exactly inspire images of the French Riviera. You know, there's all these unfortunate names like tofutti and teas and nutritional yeast, but actually nutritional yeast is great on popcorn and makes a delicious nacho cheese sauce. And the best part is there's some great restaurants around town that'll serve you delicious cheese substitutes, like Rotzi's Pizzeria delivers to my house, or Sutra up in Wallingford. In fact, if there's one thing I can ask you to try, it's Plum Bistro Spicy Cajun Mac and Cheese. It is pure, blissful, cheesy proof of what a dairy-free life can be. So, there you have it. Not that hard, right? Just take it one step at a time. Remember to say no dairy when ordering at a restaurant. And keep in mind you're doing this for your health, for the animals, and for the planet. Thank you so much. And
thank you, Sarah. So a lot of us have ideas on how we want to make ourselves better, but for some of us, it's just too hard. Our next speaker, Bruce Ryan, is going to tell us why he believes that nothing is impossible. Bruce.
The idea of me ever being called skinny was impossible. I'd been an overweight child, an overweight adult. 3 times I'd lost 50 pounds to get almost down to normal, but the idea of being skinny was pretty much impossible. That is, until about a year ago. I'd gotten heavier and heavier, and my wife, after an indulgent Chinese New Year, got together with some friends and decided to see if they could lose 20 pounds. And she asked for my help by going along with her, and I agreed to do that as a helpful husband. Little did I know that 1 year later, this is what we would become. I lost over 140 pounds, and my wife lost 70 pounds, and our life changed dramatically. So, In order to do this, you can do this for a month, but to do it for a long term, to change your life, really requires proper motivation, requires something that's personally meaningful to you. For me, it was avoiding a life of hip replacements and knee replacements and walkers in old age. For my wife, it was wearing the clothes she wanted to buy. Upon seeing our change, all our friends ask, what's your secret? What's your secret? Well, it's you need to eat fewer calories than you burn, and you lose weight. It's not easy, but it is very simple. The cool part is the best way is your way. My wife and I did it very differently, but by following the same general principle, both achieved our goals. So you don't have to follow a fad diet. You don't have to do all sorts of radical things. Just do something that works well for you. It's important to get help. See a doctor early on. Your weight loss will slow considerably if you keel over on the treadmill. Secondly, it's really helpful to find a trainer to help you learn how to do weight training so that you don't hurt yourself. We couldn't have done it without food diary software. Great software is available for phones and for computers, and if you don't know what you're eating, it can come as a real shock early on. And without monitoring that on a daily basis, you're in trouble. Portion control. On the left side, that very, very tiny bowl is a portion of cereal. On the right hand, that not very full bowl is actually two portions of cereal. That's 400 calories before you've even put in a drop of milk. I am living proof, or the old me was living proof, that you could eat healthfully, but eating too much will get you to 300 pounds. You need to get a kitchen scale. Fortunately, they only run about $20 to $30, and they're available online or locally, and it really allows you to get a handle on what you're eating. If you're cutting calories and exercising, you need to get protein. What I try to look for is foods that have, yes, notice it's fat-free cheddar. I'm not sure it's even made from cheese, actually. If you eat the right foods, you in fact can eat a breakfast burrito, pineapple, and yogurt, and still get 65% of your protein and only 400 calories. It's pretty amazing. So the second hardest part after getting started was plateauing. I lost 30 pounds the first month and 7 pounds the next 3 weeks, even though I did exactly the same thing. And I was really fortunate that I had an appointment with a nutritionist at that point. And she looked at what I was doing. I was eating 1,400 calories. And she said, you're eating too little. You need to eat a little bit more. You're eating below your resting heart rate, and your body is convinced you're starving, and that will fix things. I was dubious and tried it. And amazingly, eating 300 calories kick-started my weight loss again and didn't finish for the entire rest of the process. One thing that we do that's kind of interesting is it's a lifestyle change. We eat anything, whether it's birthday cake or whether it's pizza or whatever, beer. You just can't eat a lot of it. The cool thing about that is that when you go to maintenance now, I don't do anything differently. I eat normally. I go out with friends. I do all those sorts of other things. I just have a few more calories now than I did when I was dieting. So I've actually gotten ahead of myself. Frightening. One thing I did that was a departure from the norm was I exercise every single day. I don't take a day off. Actually, I've taken 4 days off in the last year, two of them due to travel days, actually. It was really important. I'd spent most of my life making not exercising a habit, and doing it every day was the only way to make it a daily activity and make it a normal thing in my life. One of the key things is exercising what I call tortoise style. It's a long-term change. You don't need to lift huge amounts of weights. You don't need to run like a madman. All you have to do is get up and move. So, for instance, one of the cool things about being 300 pounds is you can actually walk for an hour on a treadmill and burn the same amount of calories as a regular fit person would do doing a 10K. So you're actually much more efficient. So don't believe the naysayers who tell you after 40 you can't do it, or if you've lost weight before you can't do it, because I'm just a normal guy doing normal things, and I've managed to make nothing be impossible. Thanks very much.
Our next speaker, Forrest Gibson, is going to talk about how to make a viral video and why it's not as easy as you might think. Forrest.
Hey there, my name is Forrest Gibson, and I'm going to be telling you how to make your video go viral with a thinly veiled comparison into baking a pie and making that pie go viral. So why a pie? Well, a pie and a video have a lot of things in common. They both have a lot of ingredients. They have recipes. They have ways you prepare them. They have ways you serve them. They have times when you serve them. And these things are all important. So I'm going to break this down into a few easy-to-digest points. The first one is understanding who you're targeting. So who are the people you're trying to reach? What video are you going to be making? When are you going to be releasing this video? And how are you going to get it out there? How are you going to get people to share this video? So let's start off with who you're targeting. You know, when you get a viral video and those hits are going and those numbers are going up, those aren't just nebulous numbers floating out, you know, in the ether. Those are people. Those are people who are watching your video and who are sharing it because they love it. Why are they going to love it? Because you should figure out what they like. Are these the people you're trying to reach? Are they into science fiction? Are they into reality? Do they like funny things? Do they like cute things? You need to determine this thing before you even start shooting anything. The next thing is to figure out what they don't like, because this is really important. This is even more important, not only for things you should avoid, but for things you should potentially harp on, because controversy gets you attention, online especially. People can be raging about how much they hate your video, but be sharing it at the same time. So what kind of pie? You know, there's so many pies out there, much like there's so many videos and so many concepts. Where to start? Well, start with what you know. Just like baking, start with something you've done before. Do you know how to shoot video? Do you know how to edit? If you don't do a highly produced video because you're going to suck at it. Look around you and figure out what talents you have from yourself and the people around you. Can you make a funny face? Can you sing? Can you dance? These are all important. Next, figure out the ingredients you have on hand. Do you happen to own a grumpy-looking cat? That could be viral material. Do you own a dryer that you have no problem trashing with a brick? Also viral material. And next, experiment. I've been making videos a long time before any of them went viral. So experiment, try new things, because you never know what's going to happen. So the next piece of this pie is to look at when you're going to serve, because the timing for your release of a video, as well as the time in which you take your pie out, is very important. There's a couple things to pay attention to. One are events and holidays. So if you're looking to make a parody video, make sure you do it right at the time when the event or thing is happening. Don't wait too long because your window of opportunity is going to be missed. You don't want to make a pie for Thanksgiving and then give it to people after Thanksgiving. The next thing is to pay attention and keep your ear to the ground on the internet, because there are dull days. There are days when there's not a lot of material going on online, and you can take advantage of that by releasing your video then. You know, Wednesdays are actually duller days than a lot of other days. And you have to remember that there's no easy answer to all of this. There can be too many other pies at the potluck, and sometimes your video won't get the views and shares you want because too many other people are releasing things at the same time, and you have no control over this. Now, finally, how to share this. A lot of people think they can just bake a pie, take it out of the oven, set it in their kitchen, and people will come. They will come and eat this pie. But no, you need to take that pie out there. You need to take this pie and share it with people. Well, the best way to do that is to describe it. What did you make? If I say I'm going to give you an apple pie, you understand what I'm saying. If I say I'm sharing this video with you about a kid that laughs until he farts, you understand what I'm saying. So make sure to describe it well. The next thing is to share it around, beyond your friends. Share it to people who matter, not that your friends don't matter. Share it to influencers. Find blogs, find media outlets who might like what you do, and send personalized emails to them saying why this video is relevant to them based on things they've already written about. And finally, have a story. Have a reason why you did this. It can be a stupid reason. It can be, I heard making viral videos was easy from a guy at Ignite. But have a story, because if you get picked up on media outlets, they're going to want to know why you did it. Well, that about wraps it up. As you can see, there's a lot of different variables that go into it, and you never know if the video you make is going to go viral. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't try, because in the end, what's the worst thing that happens? You make a video that doesn't go anywhere. And who knows? You could be the person that makes the next Harlem Shake, whether that's a good or bad thing. I'm Forrest Gibson. You can follow me on Twitter.
Thank you, Forrest. All right, be honest. How many of you have an online dating profile? Let me see the hands. All right. Well, you're going to want to pay attention to our next speaker. Kate Bergstrom has all kinds of tips about online dating. Kate?
Hi, my name is Kate. I run a little website called dateswithkate.com. A little less than 5 years ago, I ended a long relationship, and I decided to jump into the wild and dangerous waters of online dating. I did not know what the hell I was doing, and I wish that someone would have been around to give me a tip or two. So tonight, if you or anyone you know is interested in doing online dating, I'm going to give you some tips that I learned after meeting and dating over 100 men. So the first thing you need to be ready. Probably everyone in this room has been in a marriage or a long-term relationship, and that's totally cool, but it needs to be over. You need to be an emotionally available dating candidate before you go anywhere near an online dating site. You do not want to be like the guy that I was totally digging him. We were eating dinner and having drinks, and he disclosed that not only was he still married, he was still living with his wife, and they kind of slept in the same bed. Or there was this fine candidate that we weren't even through the first round of drinks before he had his head in his hands and he was sobbing because he thought he should be home with his wife, giving that another chance and not out with me. And I was totally agreeing with him, let me tell you. So your pictures need to be real. You need to look like them. When your date walks in to meet with you, they should be able to recognize you from the pictures you've put online. They should not be 5 years ago, 50 pounds ago, five haircuts ago. You should look like your pictures. You do not want to be like the poor girl that met one of my friends at a Starbucks, and she looked so different than what she put online. He pulled up her profile on his phone, showed it to her, and said, "You look nothing like this," and left. Or there's another girl that I know that met a guy at a bar and he had completely lied. So while they ordered their drinks, she went to use their bathroom. She paid for her drink with a manager and she left out the back door. So don't let that happen to you. One of the worst things that happens with online dating is what I call vending machine dating. And what happens is when you first join, you're going to get lots of replies and lots of people contacting you. And it's kind of overwhelming and you tend to think of it as like a vending machine where you go back for a tasty treat after tasty treat after tasty treat. So don't do that. I warn against this. When you're out on a date, focus on the snack you're on the date with because it might be the tasty thing you actually were in the mood for. But this is not a dating race. It's okay to have ultimate goal of wanting to be married or have kids, but nothing smells worse on a date than desperation. So put your calendar away and your stopwatch and just relax and be on the date. But remember, this is the internet. It is a dangerous place. I don't think I need to tell you guys how sketchy it can be. In my dating career, I've been put in a headlock. I've been shown unprovoked and unsolicited nakedness and stalked in a grocery store parking lot. So be careful. You do not want to be this guy. He asked me for a second date, and after I politely declined, he decided to send me a long list of everything that was wrong with me. This was one of about 8 different items. So be careful. So you've decided, you've sifted through all of these profiles, and you actually have someone you want to meet. This is probably the most scary thing for most people, is the actual meeting the first time. So I have a few tips after meeting one or 100 different guys. So I have some tips. The first thing is I always have something that I am doing after our date. It doesn't have to be something obnoxious like cleaning my cats or organizing my sweaters, but I just mention something I'm doing later, so if it's a total show, I can get out of there. I never go anywhere too crowded. I want to be able to find my date. I want to be able to have somewhere to sit. I want to be able to hear them. And most importantly, I want someone to be able to get us an alcoholic beverage and fast. And I always keep it simple. I always just meet for a drink or a cup of coffee. So again, if it is a shit show, I just can have that one beverage and get out of there. But if I like them, I can always stay around for another round of drinks or dinner or something else. Don't be a jerk. This seems like it'd be self-explanatory, but you'd be surprised. Be on time. Don't check your phone or your text. And please don't brag about all the sexual conquests that you have managed to have while you've been online. It happens. Remember, have fun. This is, you're not trying to wage world peace here or something. You're just going to meet someone that is quite possibly cute and quite possibly someone you want to see again, and just relax and have a good time. So you can read all of my stories of all of my wonderful dates at dateswithkate.com. I hope you've learned a thing or two, and good luck with love.
Kate Bergstrom, speaking as part of last month's Ignite Seattle event at Town Hall. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of Ignite Seattle by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
More from Ignite Seattle in a moment. 846 94.9 KUOW. Germs and other pathogens that are growing more drug-resistant are on the rise in U.S. hospitals. A conversation about how public health officials are fighting the spread of a group of especially deadly superbugs tonight at midnight. Oh, what a tangled web we weave. Weather outlook for the Seattle area for tonight, lows in the 30s, mostly cloudy. Chance of showers this evening. Friday highs around 50, mostly sunny. Friday night lows around 40, partly cloudy. Saturday highs lower to mid-50s, sunny skies. One hobbyist describes his years-long quest to find fragments of a meteor that came to Earth in Pennsylvania Amish country. Luckily, he had help from a lot of Amish young people who saw the meteor streaking to the Earth. Also, a look at how classic radio drama influenced the work of sci-fi author Ray Bradbury, and in turn, Bradbury's influence on radio. And New York Times and New Yorker writer Catherine Boughton talks about her book, Shouting Won't Help, Why I and 50 Million Other Americans Can't Hear You, an account of her personal experience with hearing loss and her research into the malady that affects so many Americans. All three of these items next hour, beginning right after the 9 o'clock news.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Enlighten us, but make it quick. That's the premise of Ignite Seattle, a regular event at Town Hall where speakers get 5 minutes on stage to get a point across. The next speaker is Andrew Dumont, whose talk is called Projects, From Idea to Launch and Beyond.
You know, every time I think about doing another side project, the same doubts run through my mind. I start asking myself questions. These are questions like, you know, maybe I am just not an entrepreneur. Maybe I'm just not cut out for it. Maybe I am too risk-averse to be an entrepreneur. Maybe I'm scared. Maybe I just really like my day job, and I do. Or maybe I just have this deep down passion to create something, to build something. You see, if I really look at myself, the thing that I realize is that I do want to be an entrepreneur, but I'm just not ready, and I will be an entrepreneur, and that's okay. So when you think about doing something, or you think about wanting to be an entrepreneur, it's likely that you are having these same thoughts. You're thinking that you can do more with your life. You're thinking that there has to be more. And that's, you know, side projects are an outlet for that. So when we're thinking about this and we look at these doing a side project, they're almost taboo. They're this thing that no one wants to talk about. They're that thing that it's bad if you do it. It means that you're planning your exit. It means that you're unhappy with your day job. But when really that's just not the case. Side projects are an amazing thing. And because they're such an amazing thing, why do we put such a negative connotation around them? Companies ban their employees from working on projects outside of their day-to-day work. Side projects provide you with education. They provide you with things that you can step outside of your day-to-day job and you can learn something new. You can learn something, you can learn how to start a business and launch it from start to finish. It allows you to take those thoughts that you have, sitting at your desk or your cubicle, some of you, and it allows you to take that itch that we all have deep inside of us and allows you to put your back up against a tree and do a little one of these and scratch the itch. and most importantly, it allows you to become an entrepreneur without taking the leap off the cliff. You don't have to step off the ledge to be an entrepreneur. You see, an entrepreneur is someone who creates, not somebody who takes a needed risk. So you want to do a side project, so how do you start? How do you do your first side project, and what makes a good side project? So from my experience from doing plenty of side projects in the past, there's four things that make a good side project. A side project is simple. It's something that you can create and launch within a weekend. If it takes longer than 48 hours, you're thinking too broad. You're thinking outside of a side project. It needs to be focused. It needs to solve a specific problem for a very specific person. Now, that problem can be one that you're having in your own life. I know that that's what I did personally. But it can be anything. Any problem, you just need to be focused. It needs to be tangible. This is something that you are spending weekends on, you're spending evenings on. So you need to have goals set aside with it. You need to make sure that you're tracking your success. And you're constantly reevaluating that. It gets really difficult to keep working on a project when you don't have goals. And finally, and as cheesy as it is, it needs to be fun. Like I said, this is time that you are not, it's not free time that you're taking. It's time that you're making. So you really have to enjoy what you're working on. You have to be passionate about it. You have to be excited about it. Because really, it's time that you don't have otherwise. But as you're sitting there, you're thinking about all the reasons why you don't have time to do a side project. Your mind is telling you, side projects are dumb. I don't want to do it. And that's the battle that's going on within your mind. And it's natural. You know, whenever we think about doing a side project, we think about all the reasons why we'll fail, all the reasons why we'll fall flat on our face and it'll be a waste of time. But you see, the thing with side projects is the only failure is not doing. The most important thing is the process of learning that happens along the way. So don't let your mind stop you from starting something, and that can be anything. Don't think about it, just do about it. You have to remember that a side project is an investment. It's an investment in yourself, just like enrolling in classes at a university, evening classes. It's taking your day-to-day skill set that you have and expanding that. It's learning that. It's broadening that and making you more valuable. So go. Create something. Build something that you're passionate about. Build something that you can be proud of. And build something that matters. But most importantly, just build something. Thanks.
Now, a lot of us on social media, Facebook and Twitter, you know, we may write a tweet, write a Facebook post, kind of hover over it and say, now, maybe that's a little too personal. Our next speaker, Geraldine DeReuter, is going to tell us about when she just said, all right, I'll post it. Geraldine.
Hi, I want to share a story with you guys. It's actually a story about sharing, and I don't know if you should actually try this at home. It is just a story. So my husband Rand and I are very open people, and we both share a lot online. We each have blogs. He writes about his work. I write about cupcakes and travel. And I never thought twice about the stuff we shared until this summer. That's when I found out I had a brain tumor, and it would require surgery to see if it was cancerous. So Rand, true to form, told all of his coworkers what was going on. But he didn't check with me first. So I was a little bit homicidal, or maybe a lot. And I thought he had shared a story that wasn't his to share. I mean, it was my tumor. I grew it. But my anger subsided when I realized Rand wasn't trying to steal my story. He was just sharing his own. See, the bad things that happen to us, they don't just happen to us. They happen to everyone who cares about us, too. That's why we react not just when someone says, I have a brain tumor, but we react when someone says, my wife has a brain tumor, or my little sister, or, I don't know, my favorite blogger ever. So I decided something. If people cared, they had a right to know what was going on. The majority of people in my life found out about my tumor through a blog post that went up the day before my surgery. That's when I introduced them all to Steve, which is what I named my tumor. And the response was great. People sent dozens upon dozens of cupcakes to my home. They left positive comments on the blog. They sent us emails. But best of all, I could now talk about what was happening. I could tweet about it. And just that act made me feel better. When I went into surgery the next day, I wasn't even that nervous. And by the way, the surgery went great. It turned out to be a pilocytic astrocytoma. It's not cancerous, and it's rarely fatal. So awesome, right? End of story. One small problem. See, I was kind of a mess after my surgery. I couldn't stay awake for more than a few hours. I had trouble focusing on anything. I had survivor's guilt. I was not doing so hot. Don't get me wrong, the people in my life were there for me. My friend Mike won a drag beauty pageant in my honor. My mom came over and helped me wash my hair. People brought over food. But in spite of all of that support, I still felt alone. And I didn't think I could talk about any of it. I thought I'd come off as whiny or ungrateful for all the help that they had given me. So I just shut up about it. You know, I pretended everything was fine. I went back to writing about cupcakes and travel, and I figured nobody wanted to hear about the staples in my head or my steroid rage, right? But the weird thing was, some people did want to know, and they had started emailing me. See, a lot of them had tumors themselves, and they were going through the same thing. They really did want to know what the aftermath of surgery was like. This kind of took me by surprise. It sounds obvious, but I hadn't realized that when I had shared the news with my friends and family, I'd shared it with everyone, including all of these people who I didn't know. I'd inadvertently become a part of their story. They now cared, so I figured they had a right to know. I wrote another post about the aftermath of my surgery, and I included all of those gory details that I hadn't wanted to share, the stuff that wasn't that pretty to think about, or that pretty to even look at. Nobody replied that I was being whiny. No one said I was being ungrateful. If anything, they seemed happy that I shared, and they started sharing their stories with me. One woman told me about how she had decided to name her tumor Lou. Good name. Another woman said that it's not the first surgery that'll get you, it's the third one. And that really got to me. And it put things in perspective. All of a sudden, I didn't feel like I was alone in this. Heck, my friends and family now knew what was going on too, and they were supportive as well. Like I said, I don't intend for any of this to be advice. I don't necessarily know that you should try this at home. I just wanted to share the story with you because sometimes I've found that that's enough. So thanks.
Geraldine DeReuter, speaking as part of last month's Ignite Seattle event at Town Hall. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of Ignite Seattle by going to kuow.org/programs/speakers-forum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from the Columbia City Gallery, presenting Layers of the Hijab, an exhibit exploring the complexities of East African girls navigating multiple cultures, March 6th through April 21st. Panel discussion, March 14th, 7 p.m. More at ColumbiaCityGallery.com. 859 KUOW FM 94.9, Seattle. 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. I'm Bill O'Grady. At 29 years old, Aaron Goldsmith is the youngest play-by-play broadcaster in Major League Baseball. This season, he'll join longtime broadcaster Rick Riz on the Mariners radio network. So, how did he make the jump to the big leagues so early in life? We'll talk with him about it tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Local singer-songwriter Shelby Earle released her first solo album in 2011. Her folk rock sound and soulful lyrics quickly endeared her to the local music scene. Since then, she's been touring and working on her second album, due out this year. Shelby Earle joins us ahead of her trip to South.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.